For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
This is a podcast from Minute Media.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, February the 27th, 2022. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you can show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, and of course, support the good folks over at the Fansided Podcasting Network and our good friends over at RisingApple.com. Well, welcome into another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast here on this Sunday morning. I come to you early here on Sunday, and day number 88 of no Major League Baseball, Major League Baseball on lockout. And we talked a lot about that last week with our good friend who was consulting with the Players Association, Joe Casale. And I'll get to that in a minute, but boy, was Joe on the money as you see these talks unfold. And I know as I come to you here on a Sunday morning, things could change a lot in the next 24 to 48 hours. But boy, they do not look promising. And I don't have much more to say on that. I think I've talked a lot about it, but I'll get to that in a minute. Special guest, I do want to bring you some baseball and some good news. I don't want this to turn into the collective bargaining edition of the Talking Mets from now until, well, whenever this thing ends. Steve Traxel, former Mets pitcher, pitched for them back in the early 2000s, pitched a couple of one-hitters. I mean, interesting career, 140-plus wins, 16 years in the big leagues. I know his career ended somewhat with a fizzle as he struggled down the stretch in 2006 and did not pitch well in the postseason, but he was part of that 2006, that special division-winning Mets team that I know a lot of fans still hold very special memories in their hearts, even though it ended with such disappointment in Game 7 against the Cardinals in the NLCS. So Steve Trax will be joining me in just a few minutes. Had a chance to catch up with him. And quite honestly, as we get into the present and talk about the game, I mean, we all knew this lockout, and I told you this was going to be more like Valentine's Day, and guess what, guys, I was wrong. We're staring down the barrel of St. Patrick's Day, and for those who celebrate, it might be Easter, and if you listen to our friend in last week's show, and if you haven't, you really should, Joe Casale. Joe, former agent, very familiar with labor negotiations in multiple sports. Consultant, really got in the weeds with what's going on now with these negotiations and the Players Association. So he's not just talking from a speculative perspective. This guy knows. And the main issue, and it still is the main issue, and it could be an issue that we're both reading about, and essentially both sides will be standing and staring each other down for a long while, is the competitive balance tax, which is essentially a tax that limits the spending of big market teams and is a de facto salary cap. And it has really always been, but I think with the increased penalties and the lack of adjusting for inflation and some of the things that are going on with players' salaries, it's become, and if draft picks are involved in this, pretty much a hard cap, even for someone like Steve Cohen. And in a lot of ways, Steve Cohen has been the igniter. Not that anybody said that, an igniter with his spending this past offseason. And I know there was a bunch of owners that, not many, but a bunch of owners that tried to block him from buying the team, which is absurd. About, I mean, how here you have a New York club struggling financially for a long time, owners that are bleeding and drowning, that just got to unload it because of all the issues financially that they had from Madoff, and then the pandemic basically threw them overboard. And you have a great owner coming in trying to save a big market franchise and put them into another level of relevance, and they're trying to stomp it. So he's been kind of that igniter, if you want to call it that. And what we heard last week, and if you don't believe that now, you just read Evan Dreilich over at The Athletic, Ken Rosenthal, Jeff Passan, anybody. And the media, to me, hasn't really done a good job with this because they're doing a lot of ownership mouthpiece reporting. The players all along, and I've always been one of these guys that I've never been like one side or the other, but I've understood, and I still understand the owner's plight. I've seen David Sampson. I'm not a big fan of David Sampson. I mean, the guy's father-in-law, Jeffrey Loria, was part of that whole seal of gulag over there that was buying teams and tanking teams there in Montreal and moving from one to the other and became fabulously wealthier than he was thanks to baseball and really never invested in the Miami Marlins. But because a club is worth $3 billion or $2 billion or $1 billion, I mean, that's like saying my house is worth $1 million. That doesn't mean you have $1 million lifestyle. You could have bought it when it was worth $100,000. And it doesn't mean you have that cash flow. Now, in theory, if you have that kind of house, you have some sort of cash. But all the other expenses that go into running that house, that's where people get underwater and sometimes they foreclose on a home. Now, that analogy may be not totally synonymous about baseball owners, but let's put it this way. Even our friend Joe last week said, there's a lot of owners highly leveraged. I mean, part of what the issue with the Wilpons was that they were using a lot of debt to keep the club. And just like charging up those credit cards or taking loans out, eventually the bills are due and the interest piles up. And the payments, I mean, yeah, they're flat, but when you're paying all those debt payments, you know, you really don't have money to run your day in and day out expenses. Think about like in a home. You take all these loans out to improve the home potentially, and you have this beautiful home and it's worth all this money, but you don't have enough money to put fuel in the car or to buy food or to get clothes, or God forbid the one thing goes wrong with the plumbing. You're like, oh, you know, I don't have the cash. So in a lot of ways, I understand. And Sampson was not making the point like I made it, but he was talking about it in relation to the balance sheet that you see for the Braves because they're a publicly traded company, is, you know, that owns them. I understand that. But if a $250 million payroll in a sport that is reporting north of $10 billion in revenue, and teams getting so much revenue from cable, so much revenue from, you know, just the fact that there's all this interest around the club, all these clubs in internet and merchandise and fans wanting this product. I know attendance is always a difficult thing in certain markets, but wanting this product, cable, all this stuff, and you really can't fund, and this is where I've always kind of been agnostic, and I've tried to understand the owner's side. But, look, Joe made the statement, every owner should be able to afford $150 million payroll. And if that's the case, you shouldn't worry about Steve Cohen spending $250 to $300 million. There's going to be a limit with Steve Cohen, too. He doesn't want to pay even the old competitive balance tax. He's not going to want to pay that every year, whether it's 30%, 40%, 60%. I'm not going to get into the deep numbers. You don't care. you should be able to compete. And all I keep hearing is how smart these clubs are and how smart these front offices are. Well, yeah, it's hard to be the Tampa Bay Rays and win every year when you're going with that value equation, but they've done a darn good job. And if you can't add another 50 to 100 million of payroll to kind of sustain something like that, along with your value shopping at a high level that you do from a baseball point of view, then, you know, there's something wrong. I mean, maybe that's not a good market for a baseball team. I mean, I know that, and I'm not an expert on any of this stuff. I'm not a financial economics expert, but I see the NFL and the NBA in markets. You know, the NBA is in markets like Oklahoma City. And I know New Orleans is not a great market for the NBA, but they're there. And they thrive and succeed. I mean, look, I understand the NBA's had team shuffle. The NFL's had team shuffle. And maybe that's part of it. Look, if a market's not working, and it's much more complicated than just packing your tent and going home. But if it's not working, get out. If Tampa's not working, get out. The idea that you need to have some kind of like, and I think it was Stu Sternberg, who said, you know, you need to have like a dual city setup to make money. I mean, come on. What are you, a traveling barnstorm team? This is professional baseball. You don't know by now, you're not paying attention. The players have the resolve, and I wasn't sure. This is where at the beginning, the reason I didn't think it would last past Valentine's Day is I did not believe the players had the resolve to lose a paycheck. But we heard it from Joe last week. They have that. And, you know, you can make the argument it's the Boris people, it's the rich clients, those free agents that are out there that are going to definitely at least get their salary pinched for a year. That's happening. Anybody who's a free agent who did not sign by that December 3rd deadline, their 2022 salary is not going to reflect their market value. Maybe a handful of guys, but even that. There's going to be a lot of teams saying, hey, I got to think about my, because you got to make a lot of decisions, and I'm sure they're planning and prepping, but they're, you know, you got to make a lot of decisions in a short period of time, and I think those guys are going to get pinched. So, you know, maybe some of those guys are upset, but the vast majority, if not a large majority of players, are resolved to fight back. And it's about competition. Yeah, it's about money. They know that competition leads to more money for the owners, more money for them, and a better game. And look, we're all in this to get paid. No one's working for free. And if the pie, I say this all the time, if the pie is X, it should be divvied up. You don't like how big the pie is, stop spending the money. It's a very, see, the thing about capitalism in this country, it's very easy to stop something. Defund it. You know how you defund it? You don't, and when I say no cable, no merchandise, no games, everything. Don't click on MLB.com. Everything. Nobody does it. Because it's hard, because you love this game. You're cutting your nose to spite your face. But if it really bothers you, that's how you get it. That's how, and if enough people do it, and the fact that the owners don't believe that that could happen, that's scary, because every business, and some of you in this audience may own your own business. You may be working for a small business or a big business or a big company. Every company, large, small, can never wake up at any given moment and think, they'll never leave the customers. They'll leave. May not happen overnight. It may drip, but it could happen in some places overnight. And in some markets, I believe a delay of the season, even for a week to 2 weeks, which is not the end of the world when you look at the baseball schedule, because by 4th of July, we'll forget this, especially when you're getting into the nitty-gritty of the postseason and the stretch drive. But it's going to hurt. Competition is now considered something that we have to negotiate into a collective bargaining agreement. I look at Buster Olney's tweet. He writes, a lot of club staffers and agents strongly believe a draft lottery will only have a slight impact on MLB's tanking problem. What is really needed, they believe, is a more direct mechanism to compel teams to spend on payroll rather than pocketing the money and accepting the losing. Stop showing up in those cities. I mean, it's absurd. Look, I know owners want to make money, and there's a lot of expenses on teams. But at some point, the only reason that club is worth $1 billion or two or three is because of the product. It's not worth it because of an empty stadium. All that is a lot of open-air metal if there's no ball club. If they take away all these great players and put guys like me out on the field to play Sunday softball, it ain't worth $1 billion. It's really a statement on our society where we've come so numb to what actually is the mechanism to why people spend money. I mean, we're so looking at spreadsheets and numbers that we're like at a point where common sense, I mean, we need a director of common sense in every industry. I don't think there's a quick fix or solution. That's the problem. The players are 100% right to push back. They don't want to go into a collective bargaining agreement, even for a short span of time, with more draconian de facto salary cap measures that are going to limit their pay. They know they'll never go be able to battle it back. This is their moment. And they're not going to get everything they want. And there's always going to be limits by the owners. They're always going to try to block and tackle, which is a shame because it's not a partnership. And the NBA, look, one positive note is that the NBA was at this kind of impasse. And I know that's the word that Joe said you got to be careful using because legally that's a National Labor Relations Board. But in a lot of ways, they're at a point where neither side is willing to go forward. The owners mainly, until the players are crushed when it comes to their request on a higher salary, a higher payroll point for the competitive balance tax. I mean, there's so many more issues, but that's the main one. And the NBA was like, the NBA had like a 50-game schedule back in 2011. It looked really bad. The players and David Stern, that was his last labor negotiation, if I remember correctly. Things were not good. And they wound up finding a way to make it happen. They lost some time. The season happened. And people moved on. But that is a different time. That's pre-pandemic. And I think the world was economically in a different place. So it's really, really dangerous right now what they're doing. That they're not sitting. And hopefully, and I think this is very hopeful and naive of me to even say this, but hopefully the next 48 hours... And by the time you listen to this, there's a lot more good news than bad. Because right now, there ain't going to be a start of the season. And what does that mean for us here at this show? It means I got to get really creative. Because the last thing you want is a business podcast that's called Talking Mets. From a Mets fan perspective, this is all bad. I mean, the good feeling about the new regime, the big signings, what's next, on hold. But that feeling's going to fade fast. There's a real possibility that Mets fans finally got an owner that could spend and spend big, and he's going to be neutered completely. So they better invest in a smart front office, because it's possible that his money will be neutralized any day now, any minute now. But what really is frustrating if you're a Mets fan is that for years the Yankees abused the system, the Dodgers. It was fine. I know it bothered owners, but it seems like, well, the Mets, now that's going a bridge too far. They could accept the Red Sox, they could accept the Dodgers, they could accept the Yankees. It's almost like when it got to four, and maybe that fourth one was even bigger than any of the other three, that's when they said, no mas, no more. Now, I don't think that it was a Mets thing, but it's almost like Murphy's Law in that sense. And look, this was a precursor when they didn't want to vote Cohen in, and that was even before the, that was after the pandemic, but that was, all before this stuff, you knew that things were going to get ugly. You saw ugly. I mean, they nearly bounced the 2020 season, which in a lot of ways, looking back, how absurd after looking at where the world has transpired after 2 years. What was done to have a 2020 season is just borderline absurd. It's embarrassing. I think going down that season will go down as one of the more embarrassing moments in baseball history. I think that whole sports landscape is embarrassing. Not their fault. Whole nother story. But, it's frustrating. I know as a Mets fan, you're probably frustrated. So how can we alleviate that frustration? Well, let's go into the capsule. Let's go into the Mets archive. Let's bring in a former Met, a Mets alumni. When we come back, Steve Traxel, 140-plus wins in his career, a couple of one-hitters as a Met, part of the division-winning 2006 Mets. Great stories. And you know what? That's a long career, 16 years and 140-plus wins. That's a solid career. And I think when you hear Steve talk, and I talk to him, what he brings to the table, the kind of game he brought to the table, has a lot of value in today's game. Not sexy, not headline stuff, but a lot of value. You'll hear about that and more right after this.
0-2 to Ugla. To third. Nice easy hop for right. And another 1-2-3 inning for Steve Traxel. He has one hit the Marlins over the first six innings. And the Mets have a 3-0 lead.
We're back, and joining me, former Met, former big league pitcher, 16 years in the big leagues. That's a tremendous amount of time in the big leagues. Jeez, when you look back, over 140 wins, Steve Traxel. And Steve, welcome to the program. And here's back in the day, and I'm not that old, but I used to collect baseball cards. The old saying was looking at the back of the baseball card. Now it's the front of the baseball reference page. And I look at the front of the baseball reference page. You're a valuable commodity. You did 200 innings pretty much on average, you know, in your prime. Six innings, three runs, won 12 to 15 ball games. Now, you didn't strike out a ton of guys, but you handed it over to the bullpen where, you know, you'd win it seven, eight, ninth inning. And I go to last year, and I think only four or five guys did 200 innings. So you'd be top five in innings in today's game. That's an impressive career. And I think when we go to these baseball reference page or the back of the baseball card, I hope that you look back and you say, hey, you know, that's pretty good stuff.
Thanks, Mike. And thanks for having me on here. You know, it wasn't something that was I really thought about while playing. It was more something that was expected. You know, that was the norm. I mean, when I first got to the big leagues, a quality start was seven innings and three runs. Now it's six. Then it went to six innings and three runs. And now I think it's six innings and four runs. And, you know, I had a long conversation with Jim Riggleman, probably his first year coming in with the Cubs manager. And, you know, he was saying, hey, you know, I expect you to be out there every 5 days. I got you penciled in. And I said, penciled in? I said, write that in ink. It's like, I'm not missing starts. I don't do that. So, you know, if I go out there and if I can't pitch, something is going to be seriously, seriously wrong. And, I mean, that's just how it was coming up through the minor leagues. You know, you watch Greg Maddux doing that for years for the Cubs, and that was who everyone wanted us to be modeled after in the coming up. And, you know, I watched Nolan Ryan do it and Tom Seaver do it. And it's just the way that I came up watching the game and learned to play it and tried to do it.
Do you think some of the resources that would been that today they have, if you had it, would it have helped? Now, they probably would be watching your innings. They'd be watching your pitch count. And, you know, I've talked to a number of people. I think the video, you know, when you got hitters watching video on the on-deck circle in between pitching changes, I think that's a bit much. And I'm not a former big leaguer, but I've talked to a couple of you guys. You know, like, that's kind of weird that you got to zone in. But I think there's a lot that you can take away. I think you might have been able to look behind your numbers. You know, you lose 18 games, you're a free agent. A lot of teams might look at you differently because of the innings that you gave or some of the other things you did or your spin rate. Do you think that stuff would have helped you a little bit?
We had a lot of it, nowhere near to the extent that we had it now. It's more through books. We didn't have the computers at the time, and we have to go through page by page the hitters. So you'd be a three-ring binder, and you'd take it apart, kind of figure out who you thought the lineup you'd be facing the next day. And you could go through that. We had their hot spots, their cold spots, you know, what they liked, you know, 2-0, 3-1, or, you know, how well they did against breaking balls and all that type of stuff. So you kind of went through that way and created your own little chess match. By the time I got to New York, the computers kind of took over, and that made it much easier because you could really factor and zoom everything in. I could get in there and say, all right, we got the Scott Rowland tomorrow, the Phillies. I want to see every 2-0 pitch with a runner in scoring position that he's looked at over the past 2.5 weeks by a pitcher who doesn't throw over 93 and doesn't throw a slider, which is somebody like me. And it would zoom it down into a couple minutes, a couple of video that I could watch. It would give me the percentages. You know, we had percentages on guys that would swing 90% of the time 3-1, no matter what you threw them with a runner in scoring position. So you knew that out there that you didn't have to, you know, come up with your nastiest pitch. You could throw some doo-doo up there and they were going to swing at the rosin bag.
Right.
You know, just now I think a little bit of it's overkill. You know, Bobby Valentine had more info and stats than anybody had ever met coming up to that point. And he would love it. You would ask him a question about something happened in the game and he could give you 11 different answers when you were expecting or hoping to get maybe one. And, now it's probably a little bit too much overkill on that. And it's, I don't know. I think you get too much in your head. So it's, I think every guy's got to be different and figure out what does work or what doesn't.
Steve Traxel, former big league pitcher, former Met, joining me. Talk about pressure. You mentioned Greg Maddux. I think it was Ryan Sandberg I read compared you like a Maddux Jr. when you came up with Chicago. So here you are, your top prospect with the Cubs. You come up and they're comparing you to a future Hall of Famer, a guy that was in Atlanta by that time. That's pretty cool. But geez, and you mentioned Maddux. I mean, what better guy to model looking back? And I was just recently listening to him on Sirius, I think, or another show. And he was a very smart guy, and he took pitching down to a very simple level, very complex trade. And I'm listening to Maddux talk, and I'm like, he's making it seem so simple. Now, it's hard, and nobody can locate like he did, but it sounds like you had a lot of, throughout the system with the Cubs, that was the model they tried to, you know, breed you with, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we had a number of guys, myself, Frank Castillo, Jim Bollinger. None of us were throwing, you know, upper mid-90s. A lot of those guys really didn't exist back then. So we were all control location type guys. And, to bring it back, like taking his spot, that was like one of the first or second questions I got in Chicago from the press was, hey, congratulations to the big leagues. You're taking over for Greg Maddux. And I'm like, I'm 22 years old.
Right.
You know, wet behind the ears going, you mean the guy that just won Cy Young again and left, you know, and the whole city is really upset and pissed off. So thanks for putting a little bit of pressure on me. But he really did simplify in his mind, you know, the pitching and execution. He didn't care what, if you knew what pitch was coming. If I'm going to throw it where I want to throw it, you're still not going to be able to do anything with it. And unfortunately, it took me a few years to really get that in my head, that that's actually something that does work. And it changed my career when I was able to get that going.
You never really struck out a lot of guys, but it did, you know, you had years where maybe you only struck out 4 or 5 per nine, which by today's standards, they would have you pegged as well.
Double
A. Lucky, you know, lucky, you know, that's the new thing, luck, because the randomness, but you see those, some of those years were your best years. So you were just looking to throw strikes and you know, go back to the old Ray Miller, work fast, throw strikes, change speeds. I know you were more a deliberate guy, and that was a conversation.
Maybe not the work fast part.
The work fast part. So they call you – now, does it bother you, the whole human rain delay thing? I mean, I know that Cliff Floyd, your former teammate, says, I don't like facing him because he's too damn slow. I think it was some of the quote you heard him say. But, right. You know, the went against some of the tenets, but by today's standards, nobody really cares. They talk about pace of play. You were ahead of the curve maybe on all that.
Little bit, yeah. I mean, in fact, my pitching style for the most part was I wanted to get the hitter out in 4 pitches or less. And if I could do it on the first 2 pitches, great. And I didn't care about the strikeouts. You know, you're getting paid for wins and innings and giving your team an opportunity to win. I don't care if you go out there and you go 5-12 on the year and you strike out 250 guys and go 5 innings. It's like, who cares? That doesn't help anybody out. As far as my pace, it wasn't something that was conscious at the time. I don't know if I really ever embraced it until probably I was done and I actually started watching some of my old tapes and saw how unbearably bad it was. You know, it was something.
At least you're honest. At least you're honest. You're good self-awareness.
We really tried to address it in my first couple of years in New York. I remember Charlie Huff, you know, we would have him with a stopwatch during spring training games and say, hey, you know, where were the spots? And we basically narrowed it down where I was really good until somebody got on base. And for some weird reason, everything in my head would just, even though it felt like it was going 1,000,000 miles an hour, it would just completely slow down. So, I mean, if I could go 7 innings with only 1 or 2 guys on base, you know, we're looking at a sub 2-hour and 45-minute game probably. I mean, I got baseballs in my office here where I got them 2 hours and 18 minutes, complete game and stuff. So they did happen. Just unfortunately, I didn't go that many games out keeping too many guys off base.
Well, you know, there's the movie Almost Famous. You almost had 3 no-hitters. I think you know that. You almost had 3 no-hitters. You even went into the 7th inning in a game 163. And I was looking back. So I remember the Eckstein. I think it was David Eckstein with the one hit in Anaheim. Very good offensive team. A year that was a bad Mets team. You guys were struggling that year. Mm-hmm. I did not realize that same year, a pitcher, a little, you know, unknown pitcher in Colorado broke up, what was it, the 6th or 7th inning. And that's a good offensive. Yeah, that's almost. And then you have in 96, you pitch a one hitter. And I think the first batter of the game in Chicago gets hit. So you didn't get to the ninth inning. Did you, I mean, are you conscious in any of those games? Like, obviously the Chicago game, it was the first batter, so throw that one out. But in the Anaheim or Colorado game with the Mets, were you conscious of it? Did something change how you pitched? Like, what do you remember at all, if anything, about those?
No, I absolutely was conscious of it. The Colorado one, yeah, his pitcher was up. I fell behind 2-0. So obviously a mental lapse or something. And I was like, you know what? I don't remember the pitcher, but obviously it wasn't supposed to be a very good hitting pitcher. So I said, all right, I'm going to challenge him 2-0. And yeah, he hit it over Timo's head and center. I mean, he hit it great. So unfortunately that was it. The one in Anaheim, it was kind of a lot of stuff going on that game. It was Father's Day. And I'm from Orange County, so my father and all my family was at that game, so that was pretty cool. And Jeremy Burnett, I think, had hit 2 or 3 home runs that game, and then they drilled him. And so I, you know, you kind of get that look when he comes in the dugout. I'm like, hey, you know, do we need to do something? And Jeremy's like, no, don't do anything, don't worry about it. It's part of the game. But then I looked at Don Baylor. And when Don Baylor looks at you, you better get the hint quickly, and you better do what's going through his head. So I actually had to come into Benji Molina, and I absolutely missed him. I think I threw him behind him. And then Mike Socia is just going absolutely berserk. And so there's a lot of things going on in the game. Then David Eckstein got that little flare over second base. Got the shutout. I remember Tim Salmon hit an absolute missile to end the game to Shinjo in center field. And he turned around, and game's over, and he threw the ball into the stands. I was just like, what? One hit, complete game shutout. And he came in. He's like, yeah, he had no idea.
Maybe. And now a fan has it. So you don't have the ball now. You don't have the ball.
I didn't have that ball, but luckily, you know, there a ball or two prior to that was thrown out because I bounced it in the dirt or whatever. So I grabbed that ball. But yeah, so a lot of crazy things. That was really cool. Throw a one hitter on Father's Day with my dad in the game.
And what's also cool is you did appear in an All-Star game. And I know the All-Star game has lost its luster maybe a little bit with, you know, the internet and the saturation of interleague play and whatnot. But I looked, I went back, the All-Star game in Philly. Here's your face. This is a tough, you know, threesome. Sandy Alomar Jr., Cal Ripken Jr., and A-Rod. Bing, bang, boom, 3 outs. And A-Rod, I think, pops up. So you got A-Rod out, young A-Rod, first year, yep. But a guy 350 with 40 homers, 40 stolen bases. That's I mean, what do you remember about that inning? Nervous? Was it, you know, that's one that I hope you have a ball from that. There's got to be on the mantle from that.
Yeah, I got a lot of All-Star memorabilia from that. That was really cool. Extremely nervous. Didn't really know how to prepare for it because, you know, not starting the game. So I had never relieved before. So I didn't know to go down to the bullpen and maybe throw, you know, 30 pitches or whatever. And I was down there, and Bobby Cox called down. He's like, we got to get that Cubs guy in because he's the only one from the Cubs. So I got up. Todd Hundley was warming me up in the bullpen. And I think I literally went through my entire pregame 70-pitch routine.
Wow.
To go out there. Right. And, yeah, so I went out. I think Sandy Alomar popped up the first pitch. Then A-Rod popped up the second pitch. And then Ripken came up. But that was the year Ripken had his nose broken during the team photo.
Right.
And I think my first or second pitch, and it was at his head. So I'm thinking, oh, great. Now he just got his nose broken yesterday. Now he just wore one in the ear. And, yeah, so it's 3-1. I'm like, you know what? We're ahead. I'm just going to throw one down and away. And he hit an absolute rocket to shortstop. And Ozzie Smith just picked it like it was nothing. Just like, oh, yeah, this is easy, whatever. And I was like, boom. And it was over. 7 pitches. And I went in and sat down. And I just realized, I'm like, oh, my God, this is already over. And it just felt like it began. So
yeah,
unfortunately, you know, you need to go back and do another one.
When you're mentioning Ozzie Smith, I think one of the things in today's game, and I always talk about it, is up the middle defense. I understand offense, you don't want to have a bunch of 220 hitters, but Mark Belanger, the former Oriole, you know, he's great because of defense, right?
Right.
You got Ordóñez Alfonso up the middle, as I'm thinking of you talking. And I mean, Ordóñez, I saw him play. I mean, I remember being in the upper deck, the last row, and his first game, seeing him throw from his knees. And the one thing from that high up, you see how athletic he was at that time compared to other shortstops that had played. And, you know, Piazza, for all the criticisms he got, I thought he did a good job calling a game, blocking the plate. Maybe he couldn't throw runners out. He had shoulder issues maybe a little bit. But you were in New York, I think you had a pretty good defense behind it. And that probably helped that defense that was behind you.
Absolutely. I mean, with my style, I think the year before, they may have set a record for fewest errors
in 99
before I got there. And with my style of, forcing contact, that was everything I always wanted. And Ray Ordonez is just, effortless when he was making those plays too, and just unbelievably soft hands. And I love throwing a mic. Like you said, I had that split finger, so I was bouncing it in the dirt all the time. So I had to have 100% confidence that ball wasn't going to the backstop, and that, especially with a runner on third or anything like that. And I always had that, with Mike, and always liked having Mike in tough situations, especially if like a 3 or 4 hitter comes up, because that's what he always dealt with. So he's back there thinking, all right, if I'm the hitter, what do I not want to see from Steve? And so that's what we would end up working with, and to work out of the jams. And Robin Ventura at third, Todd Zeal was great at first base when he was over there. So, we always had a very solid defense in New York in my years there.
You look, not many guys can say they're part of history. And I was watching the 30 for 30 about Sosa McGuire, and I forgot that you were involved. You gave up McGuire's 62nd home run.
How could you forget it?
I forgot it was you. I remembered that he hit it off of the Cubs. Now, remember, I'm a young guy. I'm a Mets fan. And all due respect, I hated the Cubs. I hated the Cubs, and we're rooting against, and at that time, I was rooting against you. Now I'm in the business, so 69. I got
to,
like...
Well, what do you, go back to 69? How young are you?
I hated the Cubs. The bleacher bum, Sammy... I mean, there was nothing, because, the Mets had not been in the playoffs in a while, and obviously, you guys had a great year, but you were part of that, and I remember, and I think as I was researching before you came on, I was reading, you were kind of annoyed about the fraternizing that happened after that home run. I understood it, but I even said to myself, and I used to bother me going to Shea Stadium back in that time where fans would root for McGuire home run. I'm like, well, the Mets lose, you're going to be 3 games out or 2 games out, or you miss. It was weird. The Sosa McGuire thing, the fan reaction, it was obviously good for baseball. But from a competitive standpoint, I've never seen anything like that where it was more about the outcome of a couple of guys and the fans didn't care about the game so much. It kind of drove me crazy. I was wondering how it is for a competitor like you guys.
Yeah, we absolutely felt that, especially in St. Louis. I mean, obviously, Cubs-Cardinals was a very big rivalry. And, there was – you could sense it going around the town, especially with, Sammy, when he had that unbelievable June, where there were fans coming, and all they cared about was seeing a home run. They didn't care about the outcome of the game for either team, no matter what team or city we were in. And, the Cubs were in playoff hunt, and we were, I think, a game or two out. And, I was – trying to get my 15th win, I think, at that time as well. So there was a lot of things going on, and we had a long talk about it. The pitchers and the catchers saying, we don't want to be the guys to give this up. And I remember other conversations like going, if he hits it, what are we going to do? And basically everything that happened was opposite of what was talked about prior.
Right.
There wasn't going to be any handshaking.
Right.
I remember Mark Grace. I mean, you can see Scott, if you see watch the replay, watch Scott Service's face when he does it, because he's just like, I really, really mad.
You didn't
right
want
now.
It. Yeah.
Like, you know what, though? This is still history. I better at least kind of stick my hand out there a little bit. But right. He hit that. This was it 61 off of Mike Morgan the night before? And I was like, all right, here we go. It's on tomorrow. We need to win because we're in the hunt. We need to not allow 62. And neither one of those things happened the next day.
Well, it's interesting. You guys kind of rode that June. You were really not looked at as a team that was going to go anywhere. You had a bad year the year before. And in the Mets were kind of like a team after they got Piazza that was expected to maybe do something. Did you guys ride the Sosa thing, even though it was him and it was about him? It wasn't a team thing. But did you guys kind of ride that as a team? And then you get into game 163. And that was from what I remember, that was a pretty raucous Wrigley crowd. That was more about the game at that point than the team. Yeah. And you get into the seventh inning, good Giants lineup, almost win a ball game, almost pitch a no hitter again. What about that night? That's pretty cool. Wrigley Field, playoff atmosphere, and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, what Sammy did in June was just, he hit 21 home runs in a month. That kind of brought us all back into the hunt. And but we had a lot of guys that year that came up big, which is what has to happen, to get to a playoff situation. Game 163, up until that point in my career, I had never experienced anything like that. I still always, first thing I think of is that giant Harry Carey balloon hanging out over the left field wall, you know, because that was the year he had passed away. So that's the first. I mean, but just the pure electricity of the entire city starting the night before. I remember driving to the stadium, you know, whatever it was, 2:30, 3 o'clock. And then it was Wrigleyville was already, you know, 200,000-300,000 people out there. And it was just absolutely insane. And, you know, I had no idea that I was throwing a no-hitter at that point. You know, I think it was Brett Main, guy I've known forever. He was at Cal State Fullerton, and I was a Long Beach State guy. So it was a call going back all the way to a college rival to have him come off the bench and break right. it up. But, yeah, I remember striking out Barry Bonds in the first inning, and just the eruption from the crowd was just something that still makes my hair, you know, stand up on my arms when you think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So you come to the Mets, and as I was looking at the 01 Mets and looking at your season and the team, you guys kind of were parallel. You started off, all right, you come in, they won a pennant the year before. Maybe there was a little bit of a hangover, you know, didn't get A-Rod, Hampton left, you know, it's always tough to repeat. And you get off to a slow start, and here you are 6 or 7 years in the big leagues, and you agreed to go down to the minor leagues, which you didn't have to do.
Right.
You had a contract. I just want to go there because then you had a great, I mean, one of your best stretches maybe of your career when you came back. Walk me through that, because that is not an easy decision for a veteran. It goes back. I have to give you credit. A lot of self-awareness, ego to the side. And it seemed to help you. And you worked with Harvey Dorfman, a sports psychologist. I know you're on Twitter kind of dispelling this idea that teams don't address mental health. Not that, you know, there's different types of mental health, but talk about that, because I got to give you a ton of credit. That's not easy when you're 6 or 7 years in the big leagues going back to Norfolk.
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, the simple answer of it was I was getting hit like I'd never been hit in my entire career and couldn't figure out why. You know, the long story of it was Steve Phillips tried to get me in New York in 2000. And I give him a lot of credit for being one of the few GMs that was truly honest with us that entire offseason. And he just wasn't able to make it work. So when 2001 came, I was free agent again. You know, he was one of the first or second calls. Boom. And we got a deal done really quickly. And I had always wanted to play in New York. I just felt like I wanted to see if I could handle that pressure of having to perform at your best every 5 days and have an opportunity to win every year. And I think that my first game was Montreal. I think I gave up 7 earned on like 3 homers or something like that in like 3 innings. And I remember Bobby was going to take me out of the game. I said, oh, hell no. He's like, I've only gone 3 or 4 innings, whatever. I'm at least going to get deep in the game for you here. First game of the year. And I went back out the next inning. I think gave up 3 more. So right away, 10 earnings in the first game of the year. My second game wasn't any better. And even my 3rd or 4th or whatever. But the media was what I was not prepared for in New York. And I didn't have any answers. And when you don't have answers, this gets even worse. So talked with Robbie Alomar a little bit. He was under the impression and had strong feelings that I was tipping some pitches. So we were looking at that a little bit and pretty sure he was 100% right. And that and just trying to get my hair cleared. So when they talked about going down to the minor leagues, you know, I consider it, you know, Bobby Jones had done it a couple of years prior and it worked well for him. So they had a little bit of precedent on their side.
Right.
But like you said, I could say no. So I told him, look, you know, I'm not going to go down for more than 20 days. I'm coming back within 19 days. Cause that way is a service time issue and all that
type
of stuff.
Sure.
And I hadn't gotten to my 10 years yet, you know, yada, yada.
And that's a big deal. I think fans have realized you get to 10 years. That's a nice pension. And as you get to the end of your career, you may not get to 10 years and they know it. So that's a big deal.
There's a lot of guys and it's kind of a badge of honor to get that 10 year mark.
Yep.
I can't even imagine what it's like years before we get to 20. But wow. Yeah, I went down to Norfolk and started working with Harvey Dorfman. I had read parts of his book the year prior when I was in Tampa. But I actually get to sit down face to face with him multiple times. And it all kind of goes back to that execution thing we talked about with Greg Maddux years before. But reading the book, working with Harvey, it just kind of really seemed to click in my head a little bit more. And then I ended up throwing that no hitter down there. And I'm not even walking off the field yet. And the cell phone is, one of the PR guys is like, oh, I got Jay Horowitz on the phone with you with all the reporters from New York. And I was like, oh, I thought I was down here to not talk to reporters.
Yeah, you want to get away from those guys.
I'm trying to get away from them, clear my head. And they're like, it's too late. They just put it on the big board at Shea that you just threw a no-hitter. So, you know, the whole crowd at Shea is going nuts for you. And I'm like, really? They're going nuts? They're probably like, oh, God, that means he's going to come back. Yeah, but it, from that point on, it really turned my entire year around, and I think probably the next four years in New York as well.
Yeah, you were 9-3, 274, whip under one, really good numbers. And you guys, who really muddled through most of the season, go on like this NBA team run, play almost 800 ball. Obviously, 9/11 and the tragedy that happened was in between. But you look at it, you lost a couple of games to the Braves in the ninth inning, which you should have won. Tough losses. You lost one in there to Atlanta. Close game, lost one. You could easily have won like 19 out of 21. I mean, that's a crazy, crazy stretch.
Yeah.
And the Braves were vulnerable. And it's one of those near misses. I mean, is that one of the – obviously the 9/11, and you probably have talked about it ad nauseum, adds a certain – other component to that season. Is that one of the seasons you remember the most because of that? I mean, there's so many different things that go on in your career, but I got to think that's wild.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Mirrored the team.
And just the final commitment, I guess, is the only way to really say it in my head, even though I felt like I'd been doing it before, of basically as a mantra of selection of pitch, location of pitch, execution. It's the only three things that I focused on from that point on the rest of my career. And as long as I was able to execute, it didn't matter, you know, what pitch it was going to be. And Greg Maddux obviously figured that out at a very young age. And you see what it did for him. It just took me more years to I guess, believe in it 100% with full trust. And something to think about, what if I had only been doing this for 5 or 6 years prior, you know, try to make it that simple. Maybe I never worked so slow because things are just different. There's a lot of what ifs, but getting down to that simple mantra, I think really it just completely changed my career.
What you probably know is Mets fans kind of latch themselves on to the, you know, almost teams, and there's some almost beloved almost teams, not just 69, not just 86, the 99 team, the 2015 almost championship team. You played for one in 2006, which Gary Cohen has called, it was almost like the summer of Mets love. Nothing went wrong. A lot went wrong. There was a lot of challenges, but everything turned up roses until obviously game 7. And you won 15 games that year. That was a fun team. I mean, is that the best team you were on? It was a really unique group of guys. What do you remember about that group? Because that was an interesting group of guys. And you didn't go into that season with the media predicting that you'd be a 97 win team.
Right.
And you turned out to be the best team in the National League, maybe in all of baseball at one point.
I'm sure you could sit down and do stats for stats or whatever and say, yeah, we were probably the best team, by far and away the best team I'd ever been part of. I think preseason, you know, Carlos Delgado, I think a lot of media was down on him, like he's over the hill. I obviously can't expect Carlos Beltran to do what he did all year. I mean, that was just absolutely unbelievable to watch all season long. And myself, you know, I was coming off the back surgery, you know, the prior year. So I was trying to go out and prove that I was still, you know, could pitch and do what I needed to do. And my ERA that year was a lot higher, and I got a lot of grief for having run support, but I thought that.
Yes, I remember that.
I thought that's what the offense was supposed to do, was give you run support. So I don't know why I was getting in trouble for getting run support. I know I didn't get any a couple of years prior, and I won 16 that year.
You don't remember. They don't care. That. They don't care. They don't care. Nothing's changed. Steve, nothing's changed since you're out of here 16, 17 years ago. It's just it's a different variation of the same thing. The faces are different. The narratives are pretty much the same, but
yeah.
You pitched the clincher, and that's got to be a memorable night, and you pitched really well. And I know the Marlins were basically rebuilding, but looking at that Marlins team, Cabrera and Ugla, they had some good, you know, Hanley Ramirez. That was a pesky team, and that was a team that if they had invested in probably would have been really good.
Yeah.
That was not a slouch. That was a bad team that was not a bad slouch team. That was
Cabrera is still in the top five guys I've ever faced. To get out. And for me, they're all right-handers. You know, Maglio Ordóñez was on that list. Edgardo Fonzie's on that list. And didn't matter what I tried to do. Those guys just absolutely crushed me all the time. Derek Lee, God. But yeah, I mean, I get a lot of texts and stuff on social media whenever SNY plays that game, you know, from a lot of guys from Mets fantasy camp that I do every year. They're like, hey, man, your clincher game's on. And of course, if I'm in San Diego, I can't watch it because it'll go out here, but you know, you can jump on and stream it. So I try to do that when it comes on. Cause my wife has never seen me pitch.
So wow.
Yeah. So I try to put something on and, hey, see, look, I was okay.
You actually played, you could tell her, I really played baseball. It's not a fake profile. I played baseball. She knows the post baseball playing career, Steve Traxel.
She goes, oh, you got a podcast or are you doing? You keep getting all these letters all the time.
Fans love, and you're at fantasy camp. It does. You pitched a while for the Mets, but there's guys who pitch 1-2 years for the Mets. The one thing I could say, there's a lot of criticisms about the Mets fan base. And, you know, I was one of them growing up, but they will embrace you for things that you achieved, even in environments like 2003, where you didn't win many games. Mm-hmm. They will embrace you. And I think that 2016 goes down. And I'm curious your thoughts, because to me, it was unfair that the Beltran at bat, he gets criticized. And you were out in the bullpen, I believe.
Yeah.
So you have maybe some vantage point. That at bat, in my opinion, gets lost when Beltran takes strike one. Wainwright's on the ropes, bases loaded. It's an easy second guess for me sitting on the couch, but I think you're more aggressive in that spot. And when he took that strike one, it was going to be a much harder at bat after that, because now you're in his kitchen. That's a Hall of Fame curveball. There's nothing he can do. Hall of Fame curveball.
And you said it right. He's going to go to the Hall of Fame.
Right.
Simple. Right. You know, I mean, what is he, 41? He's still came, what, third in the league in innings last year or whatever? I mean, you can break down a game at any point. It could have been something that happened in the third inning where maybe we should have scored 3 runs and we didn't. I mean, there's so many ways to look at it. You know, without Andy Chavez, that last inning doesn't probably matter either. So making that play, I mean, so many
That's
things.
That's true. Yeah, and that was hit by another guy that may be a Hall of Famer, Scott Rolen. There's another guy. You just mentioned Rolen earlier. It could be another guy. Hey, you hit a couple home runs in your career, huh? 3 home runs?
I hit 4 if you count spring training.
You count spring training. I don't know. So do you remember – well, I mean, I didn't see who they were off. Do you remember who they were off? I know one was with the Mets. Do you remember who you hit them off?
Yeah, that's the one I don't remember. My first one was off of Curt Schilling. And then I hit another one off of John Thompson. And then, the third one was – I know it was against Cincinnati. I think it was a young rookie kid. So that's why I'm having trouble remembering. But that was the only one I knew when I hit it was actually a home run. So the first two I thought were going to be like doubles off the wall. So I was running real hard, put my head down. The third one I knew when I hit that, I'm like, okay, that's a homer. I'm going to actually watch it a little bit and enjoy it. So
who was – did you have a favorite manager you played for? You know, you played for, you know, Willie. You played for Bobby V. You played for Jimmy Fever.
Everywhere I played for in New York was great. I'm always going to be a Bobby V fan. We just clicked and connected for some reason. Love Jim Riggleman in Chicago. God, I mean, it's tough. You know,
You played a long time. You played a long time.
To narrow down to one guy, it's really tough. It's like people go, oh, who is your favorite catcher or your favorite closer?
No, it's
like,
tough.
Yeah. You look at the list, I'm like, God, 16 years, I could probably name 45 catchers, you know?
That's right. Are you keeping up – a couple more before I let you go. Are you keeping up at all with what's going on with the labor situation? Is there any part of you that looks at it and says it's – you know, even though it's a lockout, not a strike, did this remind you a little bit of 94? Because it's – I don't want to say it's getting contentious, but there's there's some red zone stuff that's bringing back some memories, I'm sure, a little bit, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't follow it real close. 94 strike, that was, you know, my rookie year. And ever since that year, I was always involved with the union as a either player rep or assistant player rep for every team after that. So I see a lot of similarities. I know talking to some people, you know, maybe a month ago when it first started, that my concern was that the players of now have never been through a lockout and or strike. So my concern was, how well are they going to stick together? From what I've seen so far, it looks like they're going to stick together really well. But, you know, this comes down to standard operating procedure, you know, when a CBA comes out. And, it sounds like they've been talking a lot this week, which is good. And I don't know the exact numbers anymore like I used to, but I just remember,
right,
you know, for 120 years, the players got like, I think it was like 56 or 57% of all revenue. And that number has dropped significantly the past 3 or 4 years.
And wow. I did not. And that, and that's, you know, if you look at other leagues, that's kind of where you go on the players, right, on the product.
It was weird. You could literally graph it and it was a perfect straight number. The salaries joined along with, you know, TV deals on, it was always 56, 57%. So that's probably a big portion of it. You know, you see a lot of stuff on social media about the minor league stuff. I agree with a lot of it, but unfortunately they're not represented by the union. So, you know, the players, the major league players, unfortunately can't really do anything about that. I think something will get done. It's in the best interest of the game. We will, everybody knows that, especially after the COVID years and all that, fans are anxious to get back and they'll get something done. I would be surprised if they miss games. I think they'll just be a shortened spring training, which I think is fine for everyone except for maybe some pitchers.
About 3 weeks for pitchers as a former pitcher. You need 3 weeks, maybe 2 weeks for hitters. You think you can get the season going?
You know, hopefully the guys are still working out, being ready.
Yep.
You know, maybe you start the season where, you know, guys are only going 3 or 4 innings to start and you expand the pitching rosters again. You know, they've done that before. So
sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that can happen. You know, you maybe squeeze in some doubleheaders if you have to make up some stuff, but you know, they'll get things worked out. And you know, I wish they weren't going to do the DH. I hope they get rid of that runner.
So you're not a DH guy. You could hit, but now
I put a lot of work in and I took a lot of pride in being at the very least being able to bunt.
Ridiculous, Steve. They can't, like, the bunting effort I've seen on certain guys, you could tell they don't want to do it. They don't practice it. And again, I don't want to be, I'm not one of these guys that sits on a couch because I played sandlot ball. I never played at your level. But you as a pro have to have more pride than that. And it helps you as a pitcher maybe get a run.
And I can't think of anything more humiliating as a pitcher being lifted for a pinch hitter so that guy can go up and bunt for you.
Yeah. Like, now I know.
Nothing else. You have 4 days in between starts. You know,
maybe you could bunt.
1 day recoveries. You have 2 days to go and bunt 30 balls a day, every day for an entire season.
Sure.
It's not hard.
Maybe you could. Now, the Mets are embracing history under their new ownership. There's going to be Old Timers Day. Will we see Steve Traxel at Old Timers Day? You will see.
Yes, it is just another reminder of a long list of reminders I've had that I am officially getting old.
Well, Mets Fantasy Camp. I played Mets Fantasy Camp in 2007, and I went 1-for-15. And I think I had a bruise for a month on my thumb because I hadn't had a swung a wood bat for 10 years. So I can tell you, Fantasy Camp's fun. When you play the pros at Fantasy Camp, I'm a lefty. I faced Randy Neiman. You might remember Randy Neiman.
Oh, yeah.
Randy Neiman threw a fastball, and I sliced a line drive to left field, and it went foul. And it was a nice hit. And if I had gotten a real hit, that would have been he got ticked. And he literally blew me away on the next pitch. I'm like, you know, Randy Neiman at that point was probably out of baseball 15, 20 years, and he still threw the gas. So I think, do you ever kind of get any wise guy at fantasy camp where you got to kind of like, hey, I could still, you know, I could still bring it a little bit, you know?
They're all wise until they get in the box.
That's right.
You know, they'll talk their smack, and unfortunately, they do it like the first day of camp. By the third day of camp, they're so sore and beat up, they don't really talk much anymore. So, and then by the time they do get into the pro game, they're just kind of like, well, one, I'm out there, I'm like, please God, don't hit somebody, you know, because I know I've seen you guys not be able to move all week, so you're not getting out of the way.
That's true.
I did hit a guy my first year. I felt horrible. He was actually a dentist. I'm like, oh my God, I just might have like ended your dental career.
There you go. Well.
Yeah, they don't talk too much by the third or fourth day.
No, they don't. It's a fun experience. And I'll tell you what, the competition is a lot better than people think. And if you haven't picked up a bat in a long time, work out, get the Achilles stretched. The first thing you'll see is a lot of Achilles injuries.
Legs. We had a broken leg this year.
Yeah, you gotta do that. Now, I'm gonna leave on this note. You're a self-proclaimed on Twitter wine connoisseur. Do you have a wine? What's your favorite? And I believe you've been in the restaurant business, so give us a little idea what you've been doing post baseball to enjoy life as a retired.
I'm a self-proclaimed cork dork. wine snob, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, I got my sommelier certificate shortly after I got done playing. So I thought about doing some importing French wines and such, but unfortunately, I live in California, and Napa and Paso Robles and Oregon and Washington are all way too close for anybody to really care about French wines at the level that it would make it worthwhile. So I do some collecting. I was trying to do a lot of travel, as much as I could to Europe or wherever. I love Napa. And besides the wine, the food is just amazing. But I have a small 3,000 bottle collection, which was never supposed to get over probably 1,200. So that became a problem.
There you go.
I started to get into cooking and all that. But yeah, now I'm raising kids. Got a 2.5-year-old and a 9-month-old. Jeez. So starting all over.
Will we have the next Steve Traxel out of your family over there? The next ball player?
They have softball players in the big leagues, maybe. Yeah, all girls. So
you never know. Look, by the time they get to be 18, 19, 20, the world's changing, right? You never know.
So. And, the 2.5-year-old so far is left-handed. So
look at that. A lefty on that.
I have to have Johnny Franco work with her for a little bit.
You got to get lighter to teach her the cutter over there and everything.
I asked him about it. It was natural. He didn't know how he did it.
Yeah. I'll tell you, that's going to get competitive old timers day. I was talking to one of the old timers recently, and he said, I could guarantee you lighter's going to get competitive and start throwing those cutters. And I'm guessing you're going to have some spirited talk at this thing.
Huh? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, everything Al throws cuts. So even if it's not a cutter, it's still cutting. It's still cutting. Illusion. It's unbelievable. But it's going to be a lot of fun. TC is going to manage, and Bobby V is going to manage, I think. So 40, 45 guys. I just hope we have enough time to play the game. I was joking. If I had to start the game, we'd only get one inning in.
You're going to see City Field, and you're going to be like, why couldn't this have existed when I played, huh? That's what I'm saying.
I just missed it.
Although Shea was a good pitcher's ballpark, too. The wind, especially in April and May. The wind would be really tough to get anything out.
It's September too. Yeah.
September too.
Cold. But yeah, missed City Field, just missed the New York. There's a few places I just missed. But this would be nice to put this one in feather in my cap to say, I finally pitched at City Field.
You were great. You spent a lot of time tonight. Thank you so much. Tell your wife you are famous. There are people that want to hear about your baseball career. All right.
I'm
going to send you, we'll send you the replay of this after. Steve, be well, and let's catch up and do it again, my friend. Good luck at Old Timers Day.
Appreciate it.
And that's Steve Traxel, former Mets pitcher, 16 years in the big leagues, part of the Mets from 2001 to 2006, part of the NL East champion Mets in 2006. All right, let's take a quick break, wrap up. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this.
Being in the big leagues is hard work. What is one of the fun aspects of the job? Jay Horwitz, longtime PR director for the Mets, gave us some insight.
Like a guy like Daryl Boston, being with I've ever worked with, he's a coach now with the White Sox. And like in the early 90s, we had a kangaroo court in the locker room. Like a lot of teams did. He used to put on his long robes and hair and robes. And he always included me. He managed to find me something to make sure I was part of the group. Every 3 or 4 weeks, we'd have these court sessions. The locker room would shut down, and Daryl would be presiding. He would find me for getting too many guys for interviews he would include me in things like they would buy me when Brett Haberhang was on the team. We had a thing 1 year with San Francisco. Everybody had to shave your head, and we couldn't get a hair. We have to shave your head, to have team unity. He included me in that kind of a thing. So guys like that made me feel part of the group, and that was a fun part of the job.
Listen to this and more at www.talkingmetspodcast.com.
All right, we're back. Final thoughts. Really enjoyed talking and catching up with Steve Traxel. I thought we had a good casual conversation. As the years have gone on and these alumni segments have evolved, I've really tried to change my style. I used to do it very biographically, start with their young years and go all the way up. But now I kind of am trying to figure out a way to blend what they did at different times, keep it somewhat chronological,
and try to mix in their thoughts about today's game. And I hate to always go with analytics on this because everybody says, oh, man, analytics, what would you do today? But it's interesting to see how these guys would incorporate things that they did in their playing careers with all the information and the kind of game that is out there today. And I don't want to rag on the game because I still love the game. But as we talked about in the open, there's a lot of problems here. And I think even I can't believe how competition. Kevin Kernan, our good friend Kevin Kernan, Ball 9, has talked about it for a long time, even back to his New York Post days, that it's a problem right now. The game is broke and competition is broke. And I think it's not just analytically driven front offices. I think they're one symptom. I think that the mindset of the owners that own these teams and the arrogance of how they think that the customers will always come back, I think that's the dangerous part. And I think that's the part that at some point, pain has to happen. Sometimes things have to collapse before they get better. And I'm afraid that we're at that point with baseball. We may have to have a long lockout. We may have to have a long scenario where we lose significant time. And it really seems like the owners don't care because, and I'm all for 14-team playoffs. If they get that 14-team playoffs with that wild card play-in and everything, the revenue they get from that short span of time, and like Joe said, they don't have to pay the players. The players' salaries are done already. Means a lot more than 30 or 40 games in April and May in bad weather, potentially, in certain cities. And early season baseball that's competing with still the NBA, college basketball, to a certain degree, college basketball. College basketball is done April 1st. NFL draft. And look, the NFL, which is immensely popular and is more and more because of the kind of game it is once a week, how it fits our culture and society. Like Joe said, I mean, just go back and listen. I keep saying it, but it's really important. If you listen to that podcast from last week, there's so much there that has just transpired in just a short span of time. The NFL is saying, thank you, baseball. You just put our draft front and center. And there are certain cities like Pittsburgh, baseball cities, cities down in Florida, that are already talking about their team's 2022, 2023 season in the NFL. I told you guys that. I have friends outside of New York, and they say it starts the day after the Super Bowl. Just like the day after the World Series, you and I are here on this show starting to talk about what the Mets can do. We grew up with that culture. A lot of other places didn't. And this kind of stuff doesn't help. So hope you enjoyed Steve Traxel. I wish I came to you with better news about the lockout. What's next? Look, I'm going to come to you every week. I'm going to get creative. We have plenty to talk about. You guys have been kind enough, some of you, to send me some emails and say, hey, could you talk about this? Could you talk about that? And I think I'm going to do that. I'm definitely going to do that. So sit back, get your popcorn, because you need something to make you feel good. And let's watch the next 48 hours. Let's see what happens after Monday. I think we're going to hear my opinion that the season is delayed. And I think this week's going to be a rough week for the baseball fan because I think they're going to realize that we got to buckle up. And this lockout, which is in nearly 90 days in, is going to be going on for the long haul. And that stinks. The timing could not be worse, especially for this program and for all the things that we want to talk about and the season. And I talk about Thunderbolts. Truly, this is the first Thunderbolt for the New York Mets and Buck Showalter. Because now you're going to have to prepare for a season that is going to be chaotic at the beginning because you still don't have a full roster. You're not going to have a full spring training. And everybody's clock's going to be off because it's quite possible you're going to be doing spring training in late March into April in Florida. Think about that. But the good news is, if there is any, you got one of the more prepared, detail-oriented managers, not only in this game, but maybe in the last 25, 30 years, maybe ever, at the helm, so that makes you feel a lot better. All right, want to thank Steve Traxel for joining me on today's program. Of course, you could check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you can get the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. I want to also thank our good friends at Fansided and the good folks over at risingapple.com. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back with another broadcast pretty soon. Till then, take care, everybody. Home.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.